in the hope that maybe something would give. Some kind of peace would become possible. But, nevertheless, moving with the mainstream and, on that, trying to base a consensus. Senator Frank Church, 1969. The United States was at war, but LBJ's preoccupation with pursuing a middle course in Vietnam prevented a clear articulation of the objective of military force. American soldiers, airmen, and Marines went to war in Vietnam without strategy or direction. Because he continued to deceive the Congress and the public, the president could ill afford dissension within his own administration that might reveal his actual policy decisions. Having secured his political flanks against opposition from the JCS, the president now faced a potential threat from his ambassador in Saigon. The decision to deploy the 173rd Airborne Brigade came as a complete surprise to Taylor. He responded to the news by arguing that the presence of American ground combat units was not only unnecessary, but counterproductive. He observed that the principal rationale for the introduction of more troops could be adduced to justify almost unlimited additional deployments. He restated his earlier arguments against deploying American ground combat units, including his judgment that their presence would sap the government of Vietnam initiative and turn a defense of the government of Vietnam homeland into what appears a foreign war. Although Taylor approved of logistical preparations for future contingencies, he recommended that American units remain outside of South Vietnam just as long as possible and until their need is uncontrovertible. He described the deployment of the 173rd Airborne and more Marine units as wasteful. McGeorge Bundy reported to the president that Taylor had discovered the planned deployment of the 173rd Brigade due to a premature JCS message and had already come in questioning it. Bundy suggested that based on Taylor's assessment, it is not clear that we now need all these additional forces. He indicated to the president that he was not sure that you yourself currently wish to make a firm decision to put another 10,000 to 15,000 combat troops in Vietnam today. Bundy's resistance to the deployment stemmed primarily, however, from his desire to protect the president from a public or congressional flap that would attend any inkling of dissent from Taylor. Bundy recommended, in light of Taylor's opposition to the deployment of the 173rd Airborne, that the president delay direct orders of this sort to Taylor, because they would be very explosive right now. Taylor's opposition, Bundy explained, was based partially on the feeling that he had not been consulted. Bundy reassured the president that we can turn him around if we give him a little time to come on board. To soften the tone of instructions to Taylor, Bundy described the troop deployments and other measures as experimental steps that the highest authority thought were needed to add something new in the South to achieve victory. Those experiments included Green's proposal for the American and South Vietnamese combined operations, the introduction of the 173rd Airborne to the Central Highlands region, both to act as a security force for our installations and also to participate in counterinsurgency combat operations, and the deployment of multi-battalion forces into two or three additional locations along the coast to experiment further with U.S. forces in a counterinsurgency role. Despite Bundy's efforts to mislead Taylor, the ambassador was incredulous. Taylor sensed that U.S. policy had devolved into a collection of disparate initiatives lacking any unifying strategic concept or clear objective. Accordingly, he expressed confusion over the rapidly changing picture of Washington desires and intentions with regard to the introduction of combat forces. He stated that he needed a clarification of our purposes and objectives in a new policy of participation in ground combat. Taylor was greatly troubled by Washington's proclivity to equate any new program or initiative with an improvement in the situation in Vietnam. He expressed frustration over trying to get a weak South Vietnamese government to implement a 21-point military program, a 16-point propaganda program, and a 12-point CIA program, as well as organize and gain approval for the introduction of U.S. ground combat forces. It seemed to the ambassador that Washington was trying to win the war on a point score, and he protested that he was getting helped to death. When Taylor's response arrived, the president was at his ranch, relishing the progress that his domestic legislative program was making through Congress, but he remained concerned about international and domestic opposition to his Vietnam policy. Although the Johns Hopkins speech had been a success, it had done nothing to appease those who were urging the president to stop the bombing of North Vietnam. McGeorge Bundy, therefore, had suggested that the president make a strong peace-loving statement designed to diffuse emotion behind planned anti-bombing demonstrations in Washington and at the gates of LBJ's ranch. Addressing reporters from the front porch on April 17th, the president stressed the familiar themes of restraint and determination that remained the rhetorical foundation for maintaining consensus behind his Vietnam policy. He told reporters that he regretted that the necessities of war have compelled us to bomb North Vietnam, and emphasized that his administration had carefully limited those raids and directed them toward concrete and steel and not human life. To pacify those who might oppose his policy on the grounds that he was irresolute, Johnson publicly committed himself to win the war in Vietnam, although he understood and shared the feelings of those who regret that we must undertake air attacks. He pledged that until the freedom and independence of South Vietnam were guaranteed, there is no human power capable of forcing us from Vietnam. He promised that the United States would remain in South Vietnam as long as is necessary, with the might that is required, whatever the risk and whatever the cost. To placate those who opposed American military action against North Vietnam, the president at once reverted to the language of peace with a restatement of his desire to help the poor and weak nations in Southeast Asia through economic development and technological progress on the American model. Although he made no mention of the change of mission for U.S. troops or the impending deployment of additional units, he told reporters that, "Yesterday, only yesterday, I sent a team of rural electrification experts to Saigon to help extend the healing miracles of electricity to the Vietnamese countryside." Taylor, meanwhile, warned that the arrival of the 173rd Brigade would signal a new policy and that any initiative that resembled military occupation would receive wide publicity. As Taylor pressured the president to halt the increase in U.S. forces, the JCS urged McNamara to dismiss Taylor's objections. The chief's plans called for troops actively to seek out and engage the enemy in close combat and highlighted the need for more troops to secure U.S. bases. They used the circular argument that logistics bases established to prepare for the possibility of larger troop deployments required more combat troops to secure them. The chiefs implied that Taylor was dragging his feet in gaining South Vietnamese approval for additional troops and suggested that the president determine whether the ambassador was obstructing military deployments already approved by highest U.S. authority. Rather than assess the validity of Taylor's reservations about the consequences of introducing progressively larger numbers of troops, the JCS remained fixated on gaining approval for additional deployments. The president, unwilling to risk open dissent with either Taylor or the JCS, depended on McNamara to effect a compromise between them. Johnson suspended the deployment of the 173rd Airborne Brigade while McNamara met with Taylor, McNaughton, Westmoreland, Wheeler, Sharp, and William Bundy in Honolulu. McNamara would have to persuade Taylor to accept the deployment of additional troops while parrying calls from the military for an intensification of the air campaign against North Vietnam. McNamara did not disappoint the president. On his way back from Hawaii, he summarized the agreement arranged between civilian and military officials. He told the president that it would take about 1 or 2 years for U.S. ground troops to demonstrate VC failure in the South. He reported that the conferees had agreed that the troops that he and the others were currently recommending might not be enough, and that it would be unwise to attempt to fix any time limit to the war. The strategic objective had shifted from coercing Hanoi with limited airstrikes and other pressures to frustrating communist designs for domination of the South by denying them victory. McCone recorded that McNamara returned from Honolulu, arguing to change the purpose of the bombing attacks on North Vietnam to one of continual harassment, while U.S. and South Vietnamese ground forces in the South convinced North Vietnam that the Viet Cong effort was hopeless. McNamara had gained Taylor's support for increasing U.S. forces in Vietnam to 82,000, which would be followed by a possible deployment of 41,000 more U.S. troops. The outcome of the Honolulu conference was a sort of compromise that might result from a congressional committee meeting. McNamara had been the president's committee chairman, charged with persuading others to support the president's approach to Vietnam. He allied himself with Taylor to oppose Wheeler's and Westmoreland's request for 3 divisions, and then persuaded Taylor to support an increase in U.S. strength in Vietnam by promising that future troop deployments would be subject to strict scrutiny. For Westmoreland and Wheeler, McNamara suggested possible later deployments not recommended now, including over 56,000 more troops from the Army's Air Mobile Division, a Corps headquarters, and the remainder of the Marine Expeditionary Force. Westmoreland recalled that although the consensus position of the Honolulu Conference did not contain a force to retake the critical Central Highlands, he took solace in the larger forces included as possible later deployments. The JCS did not receive permission to deploy 3 divisions, but troop strength in Vietnam more than doubled from 33,000 to 82,000. If disagreements persisted, McNamara suppressed them. The report to the president, Sharp observed years later, reflected McNamara's own views, not necessarily a consensus. Wheeler and Sharp had recommended intensifying the air campaign, but McNamara reported to LBJ that, with respect to strikes against the North, they all agree that the present tempo is about right. Sharp later described McNamara's memo as a distortion. George Ball recognized that the president was failing to consider the likely consequences of his decisions to increase gradually the number of U.S. troops in Vietnam. He recalled years afterward that before McNamara returned from Honolulu, he warned the president not to take such a hazardous leap into space without further exploring the possibilities of a settlement. Ball echoed Humphrey's warning that the situation in Vietnam was more ambiguous and hence more dubious than in the Korean War. The American public, Ball argued, would not tolerate U.S. casualties if the war continued without a resolution in sight. Ball stopped short, however, of objecting forcefully to the direction of U.S. policy. He described his resistance to the growing ground troop commitment as a deliberate stalling tactic. Like the JCS, Ball was unwilling to press the president to choose between large-scale intervention and withdrawal. As the president's advisors would not confront directly the confusion and contradictions apparent in LBJ's middle course, the United States continued to deepen its involvement in the war without a clear objective or strategy for the employment of American military force. According to Admiral Sharp, at the outset of the Honolulu meeting, it was clear that McNamara had decided to downgrade the air war against North Vietnam and to emphasize the air and ground war in South Vietnam. McNamara recalled in his memoir that his and the chief's focus on day-to-day events had prevented them from developing a military strategy and a long-term plan for the force structure to carry it out. More precisely, McNamara's effort to satisfy the president's desire for consensus obscured the long-term implications of the administration's decisions. Having secured a consensus in Honolulu behind the shift in objectives, the president sought to widen that consensus to include all of his Washington advisors. On April 21st, he met with McNamara, Rusk, Ball, McGeorge Bundy, Director of Central Intelligence McCone, and Vice Admiral William Rayburn, who would replace McCone in 2 days. The president, who had squelched JCS recommendations for the expansion of Rolling Thunder, feigned confusion. He asked McNamara why the Honolulu group had not recommended more resolute military action against North Vietnam. "Are we pulling away from our theory that bombing will turn them off?" McNamara, the father of graduated pressure, responded, "That wasn't our theory. We wanted to lift morale. We wanted to push them toward negotiations. We've done that." McCone sounded the lone objection. As he had done before, he urged the president to consider possible enemy reactions to the introduction of U.S. ground forces. McCone again predicted that the North Vietnamese would respond in kind to the U.S. effort in South Vietnam, so that troop deployments would produce no definite result. Wheeler and Ball, both of whom questioned the wisdom of the president's chosen course, nevertheless supported Johnson's decisions. Ball resolved to impede greater military involvement, whereas Wheeler sought to accelerate it. The next day, as U.S. Marines saw their first combat in South Vietnam, the president approved the Honolulu recommendations. Although Johnson's advisors had recommended that he include Congress in his decision, there was no consultation. No memorandum promulgated the decision, and there was no public announcement. In his instructions to Ambassador Taylor, the president directed that it was not our intention to announce the whole program now, but rather to announce individual deployments at appropriate times. Meanwhile, the communist buildup that McCone predicted was well underway. Encouraged by popular unrest in the South, the persistent instability in the Saigon government, and the growing anti-war sentiment in the United States, Hanoi's leaders sensed an opportunity to gain decisive victory. As American ground combat units arrived in the South, the chief of the North Vietnamese Politburo, Lê Duan, advocated a combined Viet Cong North Vietnamese Army offensive aimed at achieving victory before the United States could intervene in force. By mid-April, it was clear to U.S. intelligence officials that Hanoi was dispatching not just individual soldiers, but trained and ready North Vietnamese Army units to South Vietnam. The offensive was set to begin in May with the onset of the monsoon season. As Vietnamese communist forces prepared for the summer offensive, a crisis in the Caribbean temporarily diverted U.S. attention from Southeast Asia. Beginning on April 24th, supporters of the former civilian president of the Dominican Republic, Juan Bosch, tried to overthrow the military junta that had forced Bosch from office. On April 28th, President Johnson ordered U.S. Marines into the capital, Santo Domingo, for the protection of U.S. citizens. Whatever the initial justification, the operation grew rapidly in scale, involving more than 20,000 troops in order to prevent a communist takeover that would result in another Cuba in the Caribbean. Although he was aware that the intervention would expose him to charges of gunboat diplomacy, Johnson thought that the public and congressional criticism would be nothing compared to what I'd be called if the Dominican Republic went down the drain. Faced with growing congressional criticism and the prospect of Vietnam protests and debates, the president sought to defuse opposition, William Bundy recalling that the Dominican intervention and its rationale came under heavy fire in the very quarters, both at home and abroad, that were already skeptical or hostile to the Vietnam actions, wrote later that the president responded to the congressional pressure by what can only be described as a gimmick. The Dominican crisis gave the president an opportunity to overcome opposition to his Vietnam policy. On May 4th, Johnson sent to Congress a request for $700 million to support additional efforts both in Vietnam and the Dominican Republic. The president told Congress, "This is not a routine appropriation. For each member of Congress who supports this request is also voting to persist in our effort to halt communist aggression in South Vietnam. Each is saying that the Congress and the president stand united before the world in joint determination that the independence of South Vietnam shall be preserved and communist attack will not succeed." Reminding the legislators that more than 400 Americans have given their lives in Vietnam, the president made it clear that a vote against the bill was a vote against those brave men who are risking their lives for freedom in Vietnam. William Bundy recalled that the president's tactic was to make the appropriation of a relatively small sum, not in fact related to any specific program or its costs, into a small-scale, new Tonkin Gulf resolution. And all this in a week when the American people were confronting the idea of a second Cuba, of a communist threat at their doorstep. Like the Tonkin Gulf resolution, the president's bill passed overwhelmingly. 408-7 in the House and 88-3 in the Senate. As Rhode Island's Claiborne Pell, a Democrat, observed, voting against the appropriation would have been like voting against motherhood. The president had presented the legislators with a fait accompli. After U.S. ground troops arrived in Vietnam, the president could equate a vote against his policy with the abandonment of American soldiers and Marines at the front. Representative Dante Fassel, a Democrat from Florida, recalled that the patriotic impulse to support the troops had become the linchpin for greater involvement in Vietnam. Despite the president's coup over the legislators, domestic and international pressures to stop the bombing of North Vietnam persisted. McNamara set McNaughton to work on a bombing pause designed to marshal world opinion in support of Government of Vietnam, U.S. position for peace, and for an independent South Vietnam. In addition, the president had received a recommendation from the new CIA director, Vice Admiral Rayburn, to halt the bombing temporarily to see if Hanoi was interested in serious negotiations. A pause in rolling thunder, Rayburn argued, would alleviate extreme world pressures. Like his predecessor, however, Rayburn believed that rolling thunder had to be intensified to hurt North Vietnam badly enough to cause the Hanoi regime to seek a political way out through negotiation rather than expose their economy to increasingly serious levels of destruction. After the United States proffered the olive branch, it might reapply the sword with renewed vigor. On May 10th, the president approved a 5 to 7 day bombing pause, codenamed Mayflower. The administration informed Moscow and Hanoi that it was prepared to open negotiations. The president intended to keep the pause secret and, if it failed, to publicize the administration's effort to make peace with Hanoi. Designed more to influence public opinion than to explore a diplomatic alternative, the bombing pause was destined to fail. Planning for the pause was rushed, and the American message to Hanoi was imprecise in language and threatening in tone. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko referred to the American effort as an ultimatum and refused to serve as intermediary between Washington and Hanoi. When the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Foy Kohler, had the message delivered to his North Vietnamese counterpart, the Hanoi embassy returned it without comment in a sealed envelope. When the British made a follow-up delivery, the Hanoi government rejected the offer unequivocally. The president kept knowledge of the pause limited to Rusk, McNamara, Rayburn, and the Bundy brothers. He did not inform the JCS until it was necessary for them to issue the orders to stop the bombing. Even then, the plan was not to be discussed by anyone at any time with anyone inside or outside the government. On May 12th, the day the pause began, LBJ sent Goodpaster to brief former President Eisenhower. Eisenhower supported the ultimatum that accompanied the bombing pause, recalling that, during the Korean War, he had passed word to the Chinese that if they failed to stop the war, the United States would use nuclear weapons. Eisenhower advised Johnson, however, that the real problem in Vietnam seemed to lie with the South Vietnamese people. Goodpaster recorded Eisenhower's assessment that the important thing is that the people see real hope of progress. Eisenhower's final advice to Johnson was not to be too surprised or disturbed at the chatter from the incipient anti-war movement over the firm course the president is pursuing. A certain amount of this has to be expected. So long as the policies are right, too much attention need not be given to these people. The president and his advisors, however, remained preoccupied with public opinion. On May 16th, a Gallup poll revealed that 59% of the respondents favored the bombing of North Vietnam, while only 21% were against it. At 6:45 p.m. on the same day, the president met with Rusk, McNamara, Acheson, Ball, Rayburn, and presidential aide Jack Valenti to discuss when to end Mayflower. Once again, the JCS were left out of the decision-making process. Having undertaken the bombing pause principally to quiet the opposition to Rolling Thunder, the president had begun to grow wary of potential charges from conservatives that the pause indicated a soft policy and a weak commitment to South Vietnam. McNamara seemed more concerned with the president's liberal constituency, however, and recommended letting the pause continue for 7 full days to satisfy the expectations of the New York Times editorial page. The president stated unambiguously that it was a pure question of what happens in this country. If we hold off the bombing any longer, people are going to say, "What in the world is happening?" The president told McNamara, "My judgment is the public has never wanted us to stop the bombing. We have stopped in deference to Mansfield and Fulbright, but we don't want to do it too long, else we lose our base of support." At the end of a laborious discussion concerning domestic reaction to bombing, the president and his advisors decided to resume Rolling Thunder on May 18th. Despite Rayburn's recommendation that the first airstrikes after the pause apply force more dramatically, tight restrictions on the air campaign continued. At the May 16th meeting with the president, McNamara had argued against JCS recommendations to attack North Vietnamese surface-to-air missile, or SAM, sites. He spoke with the confidence of a seasoned air commander, explaining, "We have to go after the MiG airfields first. First B-52s to plaster the airfields at night. There may be civilians involved, since all bombs won't hit target. Then fighter bombers go in, and then we take out the SAMs." McNamara observed that Hanoi would view the attack as a major operation, and noted that if the president delayed the attack on the missile sites until after they became operational, the most you would lose would be 3 to 4 crews. In August 1965, when the JCS received permission to strike the already established SAM sites, the attempt failed, with 13 jets lost. To keep the chiefs from asserting that the administration had gone soft, McNamara gained approval for an attack on a military barracks 10 miles further north than we have ever gone. He promised Dean Rusk, however, that he would keep the barracks off of the first day's target list. As McNamara endeavored to keep the bombing restricted, the Joint Chiefs continued to press for its intensification. McNamara, however, retained tight control of the air campaign and coordinated all targets with Rusk. On May 22nd, the JCS forwarded to McNamara a SYNC-PAC proposal to shift the air effort against the north to a combination of around-the-clock small strikes and deliberately planned large strikes aimed at inflicting maximum damage in a single day. Initially, SYNC-PAC would limit strikes to the area south of the 20th parallel, but subsequent raids would hit major military targets further north. The proposal would give SYNC-PAC greater autonomy in planning missions and increase the weekly allocation of sorties. McNamara took a full month to respond. He told the JCS that he saw no serious defects in the present method of planning Rolling Thunder operations. He stated that the airstrikes were militarily effective and managed in such a way as to permit political considerations to be taken into account on a timely basis. He doubted that a change in our method of planning Rolling Thunder operations would be desirable. The development of a weekly Rolling Thunder program, however, remained cumbersome and fragmented. The JCS focused on the positive objectives of interdicting the flow of men and supplies from north to south, and of destroying the will and capability of North Vietnam to continue its support for communist forces in South Vietnam, whereas civilian officials in the Departments of State and Defense emphasized the negative objectives of preventing further international and domestic opposition to the war, minimizing civilian collateral damage, and preventing the conflict from escalating. The development of Rolling Thunder Program 20, RT-20, to be executed in June 1965, was typical of the planning process. The JCS recommended that RT-20 include 14 targets. McNamara removed 6 from the JCS proposal. Wheeler then sent a draft planning message to SYNC-PAC. Simultaneously, the State Department and McNaughton at International Security Affairs received a copy. The State Department objected to one of the targets because it was too close to the port city of Haiphong, a SAM site, and Fujian Airfield. The target was actually 27 miles from the SAM site and 51 miles from the airfield. State Department officials also objected to the strike because it was too close to populated areas and could lead to high civilian casualties. McNaughton similarly informed McNamara that the target was the closest to Hanoi and Haiphong of those that Wheeler had recommended, and predicted that an airstrike in that vicinity might result in 30 civilian casualties. McNaughton argued that the strike was worth the potential collateral damage, however, and urged McNamara to approve it. McNamara, in deference to the State Department, deleted the target, while persuading Rusk to approve another good solid target to offer the chiefs in compensation. On June 23rd, the president met with his advisors to approve the target package personally. Using a large map, McNamara briefed the president on the compromise he had worked out with Dean Rusk. Although McNamara brought Vance and McNaughton to the meeting, no military officer was present. 6 days after the JCS had made their initial proposal, Wheeler sent the final orders for Rolling Thunder 20, consisting of 7 targets, to SyncPAC. The process focused civilian and military officials in the Department of Defense on choosing what specific targets would be hit in each Rolling Thunder program, rather than on developing a comprehensive strategic assessment of the air campaign. It is not surprising, then, that reports indicated that Rolling Thunder neither significantly impeded the flow of supplies to communist forces, nor discouraged North Vietnam from continuing its support for the war in the South. The JCS continued to press for a gradual relaxation of restrictions on the bombing, hoping to increase its effectiveness. Between May and July, McNamara permitted several extra armed reconnaissance missions against North Vietnamese supply lines, but only when such increases appeared necessary. Meanwhile, geographic limitations on interdiction missions and strikes against fixed targets gradually receded. Even as the president resisted JCS requests to intensify the air campaign, he emphasized the ground war in the South. Sending U.S. troops to fight in the South seemed the least expensive course of action in terms of domestic political reaction, even though McNamara and the president were aware of predictions that an expansion of the American effort on the ground would lead to a protracted, indecisive war that the United States would ultimately lose. On May 8th, Director of Central Intelligence Rayburn wrote to Johnson, predicting, based largely on the French experience, that we will find ourselves pinned down with little choice left among possible subsequent courses of action, i.e., disengagement at very high cost or broadening the conflict in quantum jumps. Rayburn warned that the administration should not become preoccupied with military action and lose sight of the basically political aspect of the war. He agreed with Eisenhower that the critical factor was the loyalty and morale of the South Vietnamese people. The war would be won or lost at the hamlet level. He had based his letter in part on a special assessment from the CIA mission in Saigon. Although Taylor had once again deleted the worst news from the embassy's intelligence report, CIA officials transmitted the omitted text directly from their Saigon station to CIA headquarters. Johnson was sufficiently concerned to send Rayburn's assessment to his old friend and advisor, Clark Clifford. The Washington attorney responded with a one-page letter in which he made one major point. He advised the president to keep the number of U.S. ground troops in South Vietnam to a minimum consistent with the protection of our installations and property in that country. He warned the president that this could be a quagmire. It could turn into an open-end commitment on our part that would take more and more ground troops without a realistic hope of ultimate victory. He recommended that the president pursue a negotiated settlement that the United States could learn to live with. As Ball recalled, the president and McNamara remained preoccupied with operational problems, however, because decisions based on political expediency had backed LBJ into a corner. More than 50,000 American troops were in South Vietnam by the 1st of June, and an additional 30,000 were on the way. Marine units were actively seeking close combat with Vietnamese communist forces in the Da Nang area. When Ball and former Secretary of State Dean Acheson designed a plan to avert the gradual escalation of the conflict that they feared was inevitable under the current policy, it was already too late. Once Johnson committed ground combat troops, the actions of Vietnamese communist forces would determine the level of American effort necessary to prevent a collapse of the South Vietnamese regime. The communist summer offensive had begun on May 11th. Viet Cong troops quickly overran Song Bay, the capital of Phuc Long province near Saigon. The attack inflicted high casualties on U.S. advisors and on South Vietnamese troops. Later in the month, the Viet Cong ambushed and destroyed a battalion of South Vietnamese troops in Quang Nai province. In the ensuing battle, another Army of the Republic of Vietnam, or ARVN battalion, was lost. In addition to disastrous ARVN defeats, intelligence reports confirmed that the North Vietnamese had infiltrated an entire division into South Vietnam. Another division was moving south along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. To make matters worse, the South Vietnamese government was again in turmoil. A confrontation between Premier Qua and Chief of State Su over the reorganization of the cabinet weakened the government. On June 11th, Qua ceded the Saigon government to the military, and the eight-month interlude of civilian rule in South Vietnam ended, never to return. Taylor reported that Qua, the quiet and unassuming physician who had tried to heal South Vietnam's destructive divisions, had fallen prey to jugular vein politics in Saigon. Air Vice Marshal Key took over as Prime Minister. As the Saigon government faltered and the Viet Cong summer offensive gathered momentum, the president and his advisors remained ambivalent about how U.S. military force ought to be used in Vietnam and, indeed, for what purpose. On Saturday, June 5th, McNamara, Rusk, Ball, Llewellyn Thompson, McNaughton, and the Bundy brothers met for an across-the-board discussion on Vietnam. About 2 hours into the meeting, LBJ joined his advisors, unannounced and appearing confused. The questions that he posed revealed that he had not fully considered the dynamics or the consequences of his decisions to escalate the war effort to its current level. He asked, "Who sees our purpose and means of achieving it out there?" He wondered, "Will it be so costly? How do we expect to win?" Johnson remained equally concerned about the possibility of a protracted commitment complicating his bid for re-election in 1968. Referring to Eisenhower's 1952 presidential campaign vow to end the Korean War, Johnson asked, "How do you expect to wind things up? You'll get, I'll go to Korea." Although it may have seemed that McNamara had moderated his enthusiasm for graduated pressure to help the president fend off recommendations for an intensification of Rolling Thunder, the Secretary of Defense remained hopeful that U.S. military power could coerce North Vietnam into giving away at the negotiating table what policy constraints and the nature of the war would not permit U.S. forces to achieve on the battlefield. He concluded that the deterioration of the military situation in South Vietnam had made achieving a military stalemate in the South as important as causing pain in the North. Rusk agreed, stating that U.S. military force would simply have to demonstrate to the other side that they could not win without a major escalation of the war. He said that although Hanoi's response might be only to stop infiltration and emphasize political rather than military means of unifying the country under its leadership, at least they would have abandoned their current strategy of pursuing victory in the short term. According to Rusk, the objective of U.S. military force would be to force a return to the situation that had existed in 1958, when the South Vietnamese government battled an indigenous guerrilla force that did not have the benefit of extensive support from the North. Ball concurred, adding only that the United States had to present Hanoi with an opportunity to end the war through negotiation. The meeting ended with the president and his advisors hoping that they could carry through in Vietnam with the 82,000 U.S. troops that the president had already approved on April 22nd. Before LBJ left his advisors, he mused that the great danger is that we'll pick up a very big problem any day. That day arrived 48 hours later. On June 7th, General Westmoreland sent a cable to SINCPAC requesting more American troops and permission to use them to locate and destroy Vietnamese communist forces in the South. He argued that in light of recent Viet Cong successes and the ominous presence of North Vietnamese army units in the South Vietnamese armed forces were near collapse. To avert disaster, he requested an immediate increase of 41,000 troops. Later, he would need an additional 52,000, bringing the total to 175,000. The total would comprise 34 maneuver battalions, 22 Army and 12 Marine, along with combat support battalions and additional Navy and Air Force units. Westmoreland also requested the immediate deployment of 10 additional battalions of South Korean and Australian troops. If those third country units were not forthcoming, he asked that the United States make up the shortfall, increasing the number of U.S. troops to approximately 200,000 or 44 battalions. The number of troops Westmoreland requested was more than 2.5 times larger than the limit the president had approved on April 22nd. Westmoreland planned to position the forces both along the coast and inland and to use them both offensively and defensively. He recalled later that there would be no more niceties about defensive posture and reaction. It was time to forget about enclaves and take the war to the enemy. Even as he received Westmoreland's request, the president remained determined to conceal the depth of American intervention. Astute reporters had discerned the shift in U.S. ground forces' mission from defensive security to offensive operations. Although the president had authorized the change on April 13th, he had ordered that it be kept secret. Since that time, civilian and military officials had made misleading statements to obscure the change of mission. On June 8th, a reporter asked Robert McCloskey, Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, about the mission of American ground troops in South Vietnam. McCloskey, who felt that his reputation and the credibility of the State Department were at risk, responded that U.S. forces would be used in offensive combat operations. An editorial in the next morning's New York Times expressed disbelief that the American people were told by a minor State Department official yesterday that, in effect, they were in a land war on the continent of Asia. The nation is informed about it not by the president, not by a cabinet member, not even by a sub-cabinet official, but by a public relations officer. Despite McCloskey's indiscretion, the president was still resolved to conceal the change of mission. After the New York Times editorial appeared, White House Press Secretary George Reedy met reporters to issue a brief statement. There has been no change in the mission of U.S. ground combat units in Vietnam in recent days or weeks. The president has issued no order of any kind in this regard to General Westmoreland recently or at any other time. The primary mission of these troops is to secure and safeguard important military installations like the airfield at Da Nang. They have the associated mission of active patrolling and securing action in and near the areas thus safeguarded. Reedy allowed only that General Westmoreland had authority to assist beleaguered South Vietnamese units if the general military situation requires it. In response to a question, he told the reporters for background that the discrepancy between his statement and McCloskey's the day before was due to certain speculative matters and certain contingencies which are inherent in the situation, that came out the other end as though these were decisions which had been taken and orders which had been issued. Westmoreland, although confused by the White House statement, remained more interested in obtaining permission to take wider military action than in questioning the president's effort to mask the nature of American involvement in the war. He reassured Honolulu, the SyncPAC headquarters, and Washington that he saw no difficulty explaining U.S. offensive operations as consistent with Reedy's statement that U.S. troops were in South Vietnam to guard military bases. He stated that American offensive operations were already underway, and the South Vietnamese now expect and anticipate this kind of participation. He observed that we have reached a point in Vietnam where we cannot avoid the commitment to combat of U.S. ground troops because the South Vietnamese can no longer cope alone with Vietnamese communist forces. Sharp supported Westmoreland's approach. He told Westmoreland to proceed with the battalion-sized operations that Westmoreland was planning for the 173rd Airborne Brigade, but warned him to be cautious. I'm sure you realize that there would be grave political implications involved if sizable U.S. forces are committed for the first time and suffer a defeat. On June 8th, Ambassador Taylor arrived in Washington for another round of consultations with the president and his principal advisors. Westmoreland's troop request dominated the discussions. Taylor's resistance to additional troop deployments and to State Department negotiating proposals had further diminished his popularity among top administration officials. He was due to leave his position in the late summer or fall. Bundy, however, thought that the sooner Taylor left, the better. Taylor opposed Westmoreland's troop request, but, consistent with his compromise with McNamara at the Honolulu conference, he merely proposed a smaller number of troops. He suggested that the situation in South Vietnam was not as bad as Westmoreland had reported. Instead of the 85,000 additional troops that Westmoreland had estimated would eventually become necessary, Taylor recommended that the president consider deploying 8,000 troops beyond the 82,000 already authorized. In response to Taylor's proposal, Wheeler told the president that the JCS supported Westmoreland's request in full. McNamara and McGeorge Bundy argued that 18,000 more troops, which would bring the total number of American troops in Vietnam to 100,000, was most appropriate. Ball pointed out that the number of troops was not as important as how they affected the nature of American involvement in Vietnam. He asked, "When does this become a white man's war?" Ball's question begged a discussion of military strategy. It was still unclear whether American forces would remain in enclaves to provide security and serve as ready reaction forces, or whether they would engage in large-scale offensive operations aimed at finding and destroying the enemy. Taylor and Green favored the enclave concept, whereas Westmoreland and the other chiefs advocated aggressive offensive operations against enemy troop concentrations. A discussion of strategic options and analysis of their feasibility, however, did not occur. McNamara recommended that the president delay making a comprehensive assessment and deploy only enough troops to hold the situation together through the summer. Having decided to do only what was necessary to avert disaster, LBJ focused on how he would gain popular and congressional approval for his latest escalation of the war. The president met with his advisors once again on June 9th. His longtime friend and mentor, Senator Russell of Georgia, joined Rusk, McNamara, Ball, Vance, Rayburn, Reedy, and Moyers. The presence of Reedy and Moyers, as well as the absence of General Wheeler, facilitated discussion of the public relations war. Describing his area of disagreement with Westmoreland's request as limited, McNamara proposed that the president approve 18 additional battalions for South Vietnam, 16 short of the number Westmoreland had recommended. McNamara predicted that the smaller force would cover us until the end of the year. Later in the meeting, Johnson asked, "What do they, the military, want now?" McNamara replied, "More explanation." Ball attempted to delay a decision and reinforced McNamara's focus on a short-term, limited response to Westmoreland's request. He advised the president to be careful not to regard this decision as defining or pre-deciding what we can do after we see what happens. The president asked if anyone disagreed with McNamara's proposal. Rusk and McNamara reported that the senior people in state and defense agreed. After Johnson approved the deployment of 14 more battalions as a short-term expedient, the meeting evolved into a rehearsal for justifying the president's policy to critics. Anticipating public and congressional arguments against a further increase in the U.S. military commitment to South Vietnam, the president asked whether this latest escalation of the war would mean a land war in Asia. Taylor responded, "We have to explain that this is not that, not a Korean War." Johnson asked, "What is the answer to the argument that the bombing has had no results?" Rusk suggested, "We never thought that it would bring them running, and it has had a good military effect." Taylor added that the president might point to increased morale among the South Vietnamese. According to McGeorge Bundy's notes, LBJ put his advisors on notice that his reason for going north was to raise morale in the South. Johnson then summarized the arguments against his policy. He read from a memorandum that Senator Mansfield had sent him on June 5th, listing reasons against transforming Vietnam into an American war. Rather than explore the validity of Mansfield's objections, however, the president asked his advisors to answer the objections to deeper involvement line by line. The key, his advisors concluded, would be for the president to keep public relations pressure on left and right to prove that he was moving carefully. Responding to the president's need for support, senior officials in the Johnson administration had become more apologists than advisors. The president remained determined to deepen American involvement in Vietnam without a congressional debate. With Senator Russell listening, he asked if the administration had adequately described the mission of U.S. ground forces in South Vietnam. Rusk responded that they had. LBJ ordered Leonard Meeker, the State Department's legal advisor, and Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach to prepare legal justifications under the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution for McNamara's proposed troop increase. Even as he circumvented the Constitution, LBJ abdicated leadership in connection with Vietnam. The focus on justifying the president's middle course preserved confusion in strategic planning. When the president asked his advisors, "What is our objective?" some answered, "Stalemate in the South." Others hoped that military action against the North would coerce Hanoi into negotiations. The meeting ended without a clear answer to Johnson's question. Ball concluded that the short-range objective of holding on preempted further discussion. The president and his advisors hoped that, despite Westmoreland's estimate that at least 123,000 and probably 175,000 troops were needed, 95,000 would keep South Vietnam from disintegrating until September. Consideration of the consequences of deeper involvement was deferred. The president's advisors concluded that the additional troops should not get the U.S. into deep trouble. There was still room to pull back, or even out, if the Army of the Republic of Vietnam could not carry on. When the president asked what kind of losses U.S. ground troops might suffer, McNamara responded with a short-term estimate of